Hubbard suffered a severe stroke on January 16, 1986, at the Creston Ranch. He realized that he was in his final days. He summoned Ray Mithoff, one of his most senior messengers, to help him put his affairs in order and administer a death assist. He didn't ask to see any of his family members. Indeed, one of his last actions was to sign a will reducing their inheritance, except for a provision for Mary Sue, who received $1 million, which may have been a part of the agreement that had kept her from testifying against him. He had previously disowned his daughter Alexis, an embarrassing reminder of his bigamous marriage to Sarah Northrup. Hubbard was in a nightgown, pacing up and down, saying, "Let's get this over with. My head is hurting." He signed the will with a shaky hand. Hubbard also proclaimed Flag Order 3879, the Sea Org and the Future, in which he promoted himself to admiral and retired the rank of commodore. He instituted a new rank, that of loyal officer, after the stalwart members of the Galactic Confederacy who had imprisoned the tyrannical overlord Xenu. Hubbard appointed only two persons to serve at that level, Pat and Annie Broker. They were an attractive couple, his closest advisors. He was clearly passing them the scepter. "I'll be scouting the way and doing the first port survey missions," Hubbard promised his followers. "We will meet again later." On Friday evening, January 24, 1986, Hubbard died in the Bluebird bus that had served as his living quarters for the past 3 years. Ray Mithoff, Pat Broker, and Hubbard's personal physician, Eugene Denk, were at his side, along with a handful of acolytes and employees. His body had suffered the usual insults of old age, along with the consequences of obesity and a lifetime of heavy smoking. Dr. Denk had given him injections of Vistaril, a tranquilizer, usually prescribed for anxiety. Whatever powers Scientology was supposed to bestow were no more evident in the death of its founder than they had been in his life. Late that night, a handful of senior executives and a couple of private investigators drove to a restaurant in Paso Robles, where they were met by Pat Broker, who guided them to the Creston Ranch. The site was so secret that none of the executives, including Miscavige, had ever actually been there. They arrived around 4 a.m. Earl Cooley, a church attorney, took charge of the body. At 7:30 that morning, about 12 hours after Hubbard's death, the mortuary in San Luis Obispo was notified. Cooley demanded an immediate cremation, but when the owner of the mortuary saw the name on the death certificate, she called the coroner. After learning that Hubbard had signed a new will the day before his death, the coroner ordered an autopsy, but Cooley was able to produce a document signed by Hubbard stating that an autopsy would violate his religious beliefs. The lawyer did permit the coroner to take a blood sample and fingerprints to verify that the corpse was actually Hubbard. Many questions would be asked, since Hubbard hadn't been seen in public for nearly 6 years. There was another problem that had to be dealt with quickly: how to explain Hubbard's death to Scientologists. Broker and Miscavige came up with a plan. Hubbard didn't die. He had intentionally dropped his body in order to move on to a higher level of existence. Miscavige told one of the other executives he didn't want to see any grief bullshit. Sinar Parman, Hubbard's former chef, arrived that morning to help with cooking and logistics. He found Annie Broker sitting on the floor of the cabin with Miscavige's wife, Shelley. Annie had obviously been crying. Meanwhile, he noticed Miscavige and Broker in another room. "They were joking," he recalled. "They were ecstatic. They'd never been so happy." That Sunday, Hubbard's ashes were scattered in the Pacific. The next day, more than 2,000 Scientologists gathered in the Hollywood Palladium for a special announcement. The news had been kept quiet until then. Miscavige stepped onto the stage. He was 25 years old, wearing his double-breasted Sea Org uniform with a black tie and a gold lanyard over his right shoulder. For most Scientologists, this was their first introduction to the man who would dominate the religion in the decades after the founder's death. Short and trim, with brown hair and sharp features, Miscavige announced to the assembled Scientologists that for the past 6 years of exile, Hubbard had been investigating new, higher OT levels. "He has now moved on to the next level," Miscavige said. "It's beyond anything any of us has imagined. This level is, in fact, done in an exterior state, meaning that it is done completely exterior from the body." Someone in the audience whistled in amazement. "At this level of OT, the body is nothing more than an impediment, an encumbrance to any further gain as an OT." The audience began to stir as the realization began to sink in. "Thus," Miscavige said, then paused and adjusted the microphone. "Thus, at 2,000 hours, Friday the 24th of January, A.D. 36, that is, 36 years after the publication of Dianetics, L. Ron Hubbard discarded the body he had used in this lifetime for 74 years, 10 months, and 11 days. Miscavige turned to a large photograph of Commodore Hubbard with the waves behind him and began to applaud. "Hip, hip, hooray," he cried, and the audience echoed him. "Hip, hip, hooray." Missionaries had been sent to Scientology centers all over the world to coordinate the announcement of Hubbard's death. Afterward, they flew back to Los Angeles and met at the Liberace Mansion in West Hollywood, near the church headquarters. Most executives in the church naturally assumed that the leadership had already passed to Pat and Annie Broker, who were the loyal officers, the highest post available. That seemed to be as clear a statement of the line of succession as anyone would ever find. Miscavige was not mentioned in the founder's final declaration. Jesse Prince was at the gathering, having just returned from delivering the news to Scientologists in Italy. After his lengthy indoctrination in RPF, Prince had become a trusted member of the Sea Org inner circle. He and Miscavige were friendly. Prince could tell that he was upset when Miscavige confided that something would have to be done about Pat Broker. During the memorial service at the Hollywood Palladium, Broker had told the assembled Scientologists that Hubbard had made significant breakthroughs in his research. At that point, the highest level possible on the bridge to total freedom was OT-7. OT-8 would not be introduced for another 2 years. Broker surprised everyone by saying that before Hubbard dropped his body, he had completed the OT-9 and OT-10 levels. Broker even held up a handwritten page that he represented as being from OT-10. It was a very long string of numbers, which he said was a date. It was so far back in time he couldn't denominate it except to say it was 12 down and 15 across, about 180 numerals altogether. "I wanted to show the significance, the magnitude of what he's done," Broker had said. The audience had tittered in amazement. The little teaser about the OT-10 materials reinforced Broker's standing as the new leader of the church. Only he knew what lay ahead. Every new religion faces an existential crisis following the death of its charismatic founder. Through his missionary work, Paul the Apostle kept Christianity alive after the crucifixion of Jesus. Brigham Young rescued the Church of Latter-day Saints following the murder of Joseph Smith by leading the Mormon exodus across the Great Plains into Utah. Religious geniuses arise all the time, but the historical test falls upon the successor, whose fate is to be forever overshadowed by the founder. Miscavige knew his own talents and limitations. He didn't pretend to be a prophet, nor was he skilled in public relations. "People think I'm trying to be the leader," he confided to his brother-in-law, John Brousseau. "That's not my job. I'm the whip." Other possible successors had been purged or had fled the organization, however, leaving only the brokers as rivals. Neither of them was a match for Miscavige. He angrily told Prince that Pat had made a fool of himself at the Palladium. Prince was surprised. Until that night in the Liberace mansion, he had been convinced that Miscavige had no interest in leading the church. Now he realized that Miscavige felt compelled to remove the brokers in order to keep Scientology from being destroyed. Whatever reservations Miscavige had had about seizing power had fallen away. Over the past 6 years, Pat Broker and David Miscavige had forged a powerful alliance. Broker had been on one side of the gate, controlling all access to Hubbard. Miscavige had been on the other, acting as the conduit for the church. Broker deliberately stayed in the shadows, setting up elaborate drops for the messages that had passed to and from Hubbard's hideaway, sometimes adopting disguises and carrying an Uzi machine gun when he left the ranch. He fancied himself a crafty undercover operative. The consequence of his secrecy, however, was that even Scientology insiders knew little about him. Miscavige was also well-schooled in intrigue. Although he was still quite a young man, he had been running operations for Hubbard for several years with brutal efficiency. In order to eliminate Hubbard's designated successors, however, Miscavige needed a lieutenant with similar qualities of remorselessness and total commitment. Mark Rathbun came from a distinguished but deeply troubled family. His father was a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy. His artistic mother was the daughter of Haddon Sundblom, the illustrator who created some of the most enduring images in American commercial history, Aunt Jemima, the Quaker Oats Man, and the famous Santa Claus drinking a Coca-Cola beside the Christmas tree. The Rathbun family lived in Marin County, a bohemian enclave just north of San Francisco. When Mark was a young child, his mother had a series of nervous breakdowns. On 5 or 6 occasions, she received what was the standard treatment of the day, electroshock therapy. In September 1962, when Mark was 5, his mother's body was found floating in San Francisco Bay. Her car was parked on the Golden Gate Bridge. Mark turned into a restless young man. He went to college to study creative writing, but dropped out in order to experience the real world. In 1976, he was living in a camp of migrant workers, hoping to become the next Jack London, when he learned that his brother, Bruce, had become catatonic and had been committed to a state hospital in Oregon. Mark hitchhiked to Portland to oversee Bruce's care. He carried around a backpack full of books on Buddhism and the works of Jiddu Krishnamurti. Although it is easy to see in hindsight that the 19-year-old Mark Rathbun was primed, because of his troubled background and questing philosophy, to become a part of the Church of Scientology, it wasn't clear to him at the time. His current spiritual mentor, Krishnamurti, preached against the idea of messiahs, but he also stated that every individual has the responsibility for discovering the causes of his own limitations in order to attain universal spiritual and psychological freedom. That resonated with Hubbard's aim of clearing the planet. Psychotherapy had evolved somewhat from the indignities that had been inflicted on their mother. It had moved into pharmacology. But drugs didn't seem to offer a solution to Bruce's problems. In Mark's opinion, his brother was just being warehoused, held in a chemical straitjacket. Rathbun got a job as a short-order cook at Dave's Deli, and each day, when he went to the bus stop in downtown Portland on his way to the hospital, he would pass the Scientology mission on Salmon Street. He would banter with the Scientology recruiters and soon got to know them by name. One day he told a recruiter, I've got 10 minutes. Why don't you give me your best shot? The Scientologist started pitching the Hubbard Communications course, which at the time cost $50. It immediately appealed to Rathbun. The problem is I've only got $25 to my entire name, he said. The recruiter let him take the course and threw in a copy of Dianetics as well. At that first course, Rathbun went exterior. It was completely real to him. All the Eastern philosophy he had absorbed had been leading to this moment. He finally realized that he was separate from his body. Hadn't this been the point of the Buddha's teachings, to isolate the spirit and end the repetitive cycle of life and death? From that moment on, Rathbun never looked back. He was transformed. Another recruiter persuaded Rathbun that he would be better able to deal with his brother's problems if he had more training, which he could afford if he joined the Sea Org. Rathbun signed the billion-year contract in January 1978. Footnote: Rathbun was never able to apply those advanced techniques on his brother. In 1981, two boys walking their dogs near a vacant lot in Garden Grove, California, discovered Bruce Rathbun's body buried under a pile of debris. The cause of death was never determined, and the case was never resolved. www.ci.garden-grove.ca.us/?q=police/unsolved/1981/Rathbun. End footnote. A few months later, Rathbun was sent to work in L.A. One night, he was assigned to escort Diane Coletto, the 25-year-old editor of Scientology's Auditor magazine, from the publications building to the Scientology complex in Hollywood, where they both lived. It was late at night on August 19, 1978. Diane was a petite and mousy intellectual with thick glasses. A diligent worker, she was often the last to leave the office. On this night, she was frightened. Diane's husband, John Coletto, a highly trained auditor, had recently been declared a suppressive person. John had gotten into an argument with church officials over a matter of policy. After being declared, he went to visit a Scientology chaplain who could see that he was having a breakdown. He kept crying and grabbing his head in despair. At that point, he was forcibly detained in the RPF. He spent several weeks there, but managed to escape. Diane was ordered to disconnect from him. She told the chaplain that John had threatened her, saying that if he couldn't have Scientology, then neither could she. Rathbun, a big man, a former college basketball player, knew nothing of this as he rode back to the berthing with Diane in her Fiat. She was uncommunicative. She drove north on Rampart Boulevard, where the Pubs Org was located, to Sunset, and then left on Santa Monica Boulevard. It was mid-August, but there was a breeze from the ocean, and the night air was unseasonably cool. As soon as Diane turned the corner from North Edgemont Street onto Fountain Avenue, in front of the Scientology complex, a pair of headlights on high beam blinded them. Then a car rammed into them, pinning Diane's vehicle against the curb. Rathbun was in shock, but he managed to get out of the passenger side of the car. They had come to a stop in front of a small house with a picket fence. He saw the man in the other car get out and run toward Diane, who was still in the driver's seat. Rathbun came around the front of the car just in time to hear a popping noise and the sound of glass shattering. It was the first time in his life he had ever heard a gunshot. Jesse Prince, who was in RPF on the 7th floor, heard the sound and rushed to the windows. People were shouting, "John Coletto!" Everyone knew immediately what was happening. Rathbun grabbed Coletto and they spun around in the street. He got Coletto in a headlock, but Coletto pistol-whipped him and Rathbun momentarily lost consciousness. Both of them tumbled to the ground. When Rathbun recovered, he saw Diane on all fours, crawling on the sidewalk, and Coletto running toward her with the gun. Rathbun says he got up and tackled John. They crashed through the picket fence and wrestled on the lawn. More shots were fired. At one point, according to Rathbun, the barrel of the revolver was pressed against the nape of his neck, and Coletto pulled the trigger. The gun didn't fire, but Rathbun went exterior, viewing the scene from 12 feet above his body. Coletto broke free and caught up to his wife. He stuck the gun in her ear. Rathbun says he saw what was happening and did a flying sidekick, but at that fatal moment, the gun fired. Coletto was knocked to the ground by Rathbun's blow, and the gun skittered across the pavement. Rathbun picked it up and tried to fire it at Coletto, but the chambers were all empty. Coletto got in his car and screeched away. Rathbun went back to Diane. Blood was gurgling and spewing from her mouth. He thought she was drowning in her own blood. Rathbun took off his shirt and put it under her head. As he heard the sirens screaming, she died in his arms. Footnote: The police report confirms Rathbun's story. A suspect, tentatively ID'd as her husband, fired one shot through the driver's side of the auto, the report states. He then forced her vehicle to stop, got out, and became involved in a fight with her male companion, during which time he was firing the weapon, a .22-caliber, short, 8-shot revolver. The male companion was able to wrest the revolver from the suspect, at which point the husband fled. The companion was identified as Mark Rathbun. The empty gun was found at the scene. Michael A. Shepard, County of Los Angeles Case Report, August 19, 1978. End footnote. 3 days later, John Coletto's decomposing body was found. He had slashed his wrists and bled to death on the shoulder of the Ventura Freeway. Because of this incident, Rathbun was singled out for his fearlessness, or what Scientology terms his high level of confront. Soon after that, he was sent to La Quinta, Hubbard's winter headquarters, where the old man was just then building up his movie-making enterprise. Miscavige had appointed Rathbun head of what was known as the All Clear Unit. The object was to resolve the dozens of lawsuits around the country that had named Hubbard as a defendant. He was also the target of grand juries in Tampa, New York, and Washington, D.C. Hubbard wanted to be able to return to his movie-making full-time, but he was afraid to show himself until he was assured that he wouldn't be hauled into court. He died before that happened. Like many Sea Org members on the secret base, Rathbun adopted an alias for security reasons, one that was similar to his real name but that separated him from his previous identity. It also made it more difficult for anyone to find him. Mark became Marty. As the new church leader, Pat Broker quickly sought to exert his influence. He had a special uniform made up for himself with solid gold epaulettes and a loyal officer flag that was to be flown wherever he was in residence. He announced that he was going to issue a new grade chart on Sea Org Day in Clearwater. He justified the alteration of Hubbard's sacred material with his own divinations because he claimed to be in telepathic communication with the founder. His Sea Org Day speech was stymied, however, when he was told that church authorities expected that a government raid would take place if he showed himself in public. That wasn't true, but it wasn't out of the question. For several years, the leaders of the church, including Hubbard, Miscavige, and Broker, had been targets of an IRS criminal investigation. Church lawyers persuaded Broker that while the investigation was still ongoing, he should confine himself to another ranch near Creston that Hubbard had purchased. Broker was content with that arrangement. He seemed more at home with the quarter horses that he so lovingly purchased with the church's money than he did with the bureaucrats in the church hierarchy. he continued shopping for exemplary breeding stock even after Hubbard's death, claiming he was carrying out the founder's vision. He seemed to think he could run the church from the sidelines. Other than Hubbard's imprimatur, Broecker had few assets on his side. He had the unfortunate combination of being garrulous without being articulate. Many of the executives he had been close to had been forced out of the church or had fled. Even people who didn't like him, however, were fond of Annie. She was in many ways her husband's opposite. She was measured where he was goofy and impetuous. Sweet and shy, with a fragile beauty that some compared to the actress Jessica Lange, Annie had been born into Scientology and was one of the few original messengers who hadn't been purged. In 1982, Hubbard had made her Inspector General of the Religious Technology Center, the highest post in the church bureaucracy, in charge of protecting the sanctity of Scientology's spiritual technology. It was a job she was ill-suited for, by nature and also by circumstance, as she was not an auditor, and for years she had been living at the remote ranch as Hubbard's caretaker, away from the administration of church affairs. In March 1987, Miscavige seized control of the RTC, making himself the chairman of the board. He downgraded the inspector general's post by dividing it into three parts. His new lieutenant and henchman, Marty Rathbun, became the IG for ethics. Still, both Pat and Annie remained untouchable because of Hubbard's final decree. And most tantalizingly, only Pat seemed to know where the new OT levels, which he now claimed went all the way up to 15, were hidden. They were his insurance. Nothing could be more precious in the world of Scientology. To its members, who sought to gain Hubbard's final revelations on the bridge to total freedom, and to the organization, which profited from that journey. At Miscavige's direction, Rathbun hired a team of private investigators to follow Broecker and dig into his private life. One of them was a former cop who met Broecker at a gun show, then began frequenting Broecker's favorite tavern. He would chat him up whenever he came in. They got to be so friendly that at Christmas the ex-cop gave Broecker a cordless phone. Because such phones emit a weak radio signal, Rathbun's minions were able to record Broecker's calls. The detectives followed him everywhere, but there was no clue as to where the secret OT levels might be hidden. Miscavige still worried that Broecker was holding vital material back. A few months later, he and church attorneys went to the ranch to persuade the Broeckers to hand over whatever confidential materials they might have to the church for safekeeping. While this was going on, a gang of a dozen powerful men assembled by Rathbun surrounded the ranch quarters and hid in the bushes. Inside the ranch house, Miscavige and the lawyers argued that Scientology would never get its tax exemption if the church did not have in its possession its most important documents. Miscavige also threatened Broecker with the prospect of criminal prosecution. Rathbun had discovered that there was $1.8 million of Hubbard's funds that Broecker couldn't account for. Broecker appeared to cave in. He let Rathbun load the file cabinets in the ranch house into a truck. Had Broecker not agreed, Rathbun was prepared to signal his goon squad to storm the place and seize everything. It took months to sort through the voluminous files, only to find that there was really nothing there, certainly nothing that resembled new OT levels. In November 1987, the IRS notified the church that its criminal investigation had concluded. No charges were filed. But that also reduced the leverage Miscavige had over Broecker. A few months later, Miscavige decided that a final operation to retrieve the missing OT levels was in order. This time there would be no subterfuge, no subtle argument. Rathbun brought along a team of armed private investigators and off-duty LA cops as muscle, along with several other church executives. One of them found $50,000 stashed under the kitchen sink. Miscavige concentrated his attention on Annie. He took her to a separate room and interrogated her as a detective barred the door, preventing her husband from seeing her. Eventually, Annie admitted that Pat kept a storage locker in nearby Paso Robles, and she coughed up the key. Rathbun's team found more files, but not what they wanted. Rathbun eventually came to the conclusion that there were no further OT levels. No OT 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. It was all a bluff on Broker's part, a lie that the church would have to live with since the levels had been so publicly announced. Footnote: none of the promised levels has ever been released. End footnote. In April 1988, Miscavige formally canceled Hubbard's final directive, Flag Order 3879, that had named the Brokers loyal officers. Miscavige declared that Pat Broker had fabricated the order, although he produced no evidence to substantiate his charge. Broker's last claim to the legacy of L. Ron Hubbard was destroyed. He fled the country, followed by two private detectives, Paul Merrick and Greg Arnold, who claimed that they tailed Broker for the next 24 years, even to foreign countries. They say they were supervised personally by David Miscavige and paid from church funds. He lived a very quiet, normal life, and everybody around him loves him, Merrick later said of Broker. So that's his whole story, from our perspective. The same day that Miscavige canceled Hubbard's order, Annie showed up in a remote re-education camp in the Saboba Indian Reservation in Southern California that Scientologists call Happy Valley. It had once belonged to an order of nuns who left a sign on the gate that said, Valley of the Singing Heart. An armed guard stood watch. Dogs were trained to track down anyone who tried to leave. Miscavige was now in complete control. Chapter 6. In Service to the Stars. In 1986, the same year that L. Ron Hubbard died, Paul Haggis appeared on the cover of the church's Celebrity magazine, marking his entry into the pantheon of the Scientology elite. The photo shows Haggis sitting in a director's chair holding a coffee cup. He's clean-shaven, with glasses, wearing a herringbone jacket with a pocket square in the breast pocket and pleated linen slacks, looking like a nerdy Hollywood executive with a lot of money to spend on clothes. The article took note of his rising influence in Hollywood. He had broken free of the cartoon ghetto after selling a script to The Love Boat, then ascended through the ranks of network television, writing movies of the week and children's shows before settling into sitcoms. He worked on Different Strokes, Who's the Boss, and One Day at a Time. He was now the executive producer of The Facts of Life, a top-rated Saturday night staple. Celebrity noted, he is one of the few writers in Hollywood who has major credits in all genres, comedy, suspense, human drama, animation. In the article, Haggis said of Scientology, what excited me about the technology was that you could actually handle life and your problems and not have them handle you. He added, I also liked the motto, Scientology makes the able more able. He credited the church for improving his relationship with his wife, Diane. Instead of fighting, we did a lot of that before Scientology philosophy, we now talk things out, listen to each other, and apply Scientology technology to our problems. Haggis told the magazine that he had recently gone through the Purification Rundown, a program intended to eliminate body toxins that form a biochemical barrier to spiritual well-being. For an average of 3 weeks, participants undergo a lengthy daily regimen, spending up to 8 hours a day in a sauna, interspersed with exercise, and taking massive doses of vitamins, especially niacin. In large amounts, niacin can cause liver damage, but it will also stimulate the skin to flush and create a tingling sensation. The church says that this is evidence of drugs and other toxins being purged from the body. Although many in the medical profession have been hostile to the purification rundown, citing it as a fraud and a scam, Hubbard thought he deserved a Nobel Prize for it. In the Celebrity interview, Haggis admitted that he had been skeptical of the procedure before going through it. "My idea of doing good for my body was smoking low-tar cigarettes." But the purification rundown, he said, was wonderful. "I really did feel more alert and more aware and more at ease. I wasn't running in six directions to get something done or bouncing off the walls when something went wrong." He mentioned the drugs that he had taken when he was young. "Getting rid of all those residual toxins and medicines and drugs really had an effect," he said. "After completing the rundown, I drank a diet cola and suddenly could really taste it, every single chemical." He had recommended the rundown to others, including his mother, when she was seriously ill, and had persuaded a young writer on his staff to take the course in order to wean herself from various medications. "She could tell Scientology worked by the example I set," Haggis told the magazine. "That made me feel very good." The purification rundown is a fundamental feature of Scientology's drug rehabilitation program, Narcanon, which operates nearly 200 residential centers around the world. Celebrity Scientologists conspicuously promote Narcanon, citing the church's claims that Narcanon is the most effective rehabilitation program there is. Kirstie Alley, who served as the national spokesperson for Narcanon for a number of years, describes herself as the heart and soul of the project because it had helped break her dependency on cocaine. A year after 9/11, Tom Cruise set up a program for over 1,000 rescue workers in New York to go through a similar procedure, which was paid for in part by using city money. Many participants reported positive results, saying that they had sweated a kind of black paste through their pores while in the sauna. The borough of Manhattan gratefully declared March 13th, Hubbard's birthday, 2004, as Hubbard Detoxification Day. Kelly Preston has promoted Narcanon in her native Hawaii. "Starting in the schools, we've delivered to over 10,000 different kids," she said. Preston and Travolta's 16-year-old son, Jet, who was autistic, died of a seizure in January 2009. His parents had taken him off of Depakote, an anti-seizure medication, saying it was ineffective. The church claims that it does not oppose the use of such drugs when prescribed by a doctor. However, Hubbard himself denounced the use of anti-seizure medications. Previously, Preston asserted on the Montel Williams show that Jet suffered from Kawasaki syndrome, a rare disorder that she thought was brought on by his exposure to pesticides and household chemicals. "With Jet, you started him on a program that I think is talked about in this book by L. Ron Hubbard," Williams said, holding up Clear Body, Clear Mind, which outlines the principles of the purification rundown. "Exactly," Preston replied. Footnote: a lawyer for Preston and Travolta claims that the couple never put their son through a purification rundown treatment and would never have engaged in any type of conduct that would have endangered their son's health, welfare, or well-being in any way. He maintains that Preston was referring to herself when she responded to Williams's question. End footnote. She then talked about her own profound experience on the program. Novocaine from previous dental work began to surface. "I had my entire mouth get numb again for an hour and a half," she said. Other drugs were purged as well, along with radiation exposure from the sun. "I had a bathing suit when I was 7 years old. This is completely true. I had a bathing suit that I thought was so cool, with holes in the side and a hole in the center," she said. "And I got a sunburn in it. And 20 years later, I had this same sunburn come out in my skin, the entire sunburn." Preston brought copies of Hubbard's book for the entire studio audience. Despite his exuberant testimonial, Haggis was increasingly troubled by the contradictions in the church. Scientology had begun to seem like two different things, a systematic approach to self-knowledge, which he found useful and insightful, and a religion that he simply couldn't grasp. He liked and admired his auditor, and the confessions were helpful, and he continued to advance on the bridge even after his unsettling encounter with OT3. He saw so many intelligent people on the path, and he always expected that his concerns would be addressed at the next level. They never were. After OT3, it was all intergalactic spirituality, in his opinion. On the other hand, he had already paid for the complete package, so why not continue and see what happened? Maybe there is something, and I'm missing it, he told himself. When Haggis reached OT7, which was the peak at the time, he still felt confused and unsatisfied. At the top of the OT pyramid, the Thetan was promised the ability to control thought, life, form, matter, energy, space and time, subjective and objective. The final exercise, according to documents obtained by WikiLeaks, Haggis refused to talk about it, was go out to a park, train station, or other busy area. Practice placing an intention into individuals until you can successfully and easily place an intention into or on a being and or a body. But even if you could do that, how would you know if you succeeded? If you were transmitting the intention, scratch your head, and a person did so, was he responding to your psychic order, or was it simply coincidental? It was difficult to evaluate. Haggis thought that Hubbard was such a brilliant intellect that the failure to grasp these concepts and abilities must be his alone. He finally confided to a counselor at the Celebrity Center that he didn't think he was a very good Scientologist because he couldn't bring himself to believe. He said he felt like a fraud and thought he might have to leave the church. She told him, "There are all sorts of Scientologists, just as there are many varieties of Jews and Christians with varying levels of belief." The implication was that Haggis could believe whatever he wanted, to pick and choose, as he says. Haggis's career was going so well that in 1987 he was approached by Ed Zwick and Marshall Herskovitz to write for a new television series called 30-something. They were looking for distinctive voices. "I love the fact that you guys are doing a show that's about emotions," Haggis told them. "I hate writing about emotions, and I don't like to talk about my own." But he seemed to be looking for a chance to push himself creatively. With his first script, Zwick and Herskovitz told him, "This is really good, but where does it come from?" Haggis didn't know what they meant. "Where does it come from within you?" they explained. The thought that his own experience mattered was a revelation. Zwick and Herskovitz sensed that Haggis wasn't happy on the show. In any case, he got a lucrative offer to create his own series and left after the first season. But he had won 2 Emmys for writing and producing, and the experience transformed him as a writer. From working with Zwick and Herskovitz, Haggis became interested in directing. He finally got the chance to do a brief ad for the church about Dianetics. He decided against the usual portrayal of Scientology as a triumphal march toward enlightenment, choosing instead to shoot a group of people talking about practical ways they had used Dianetics in their lives. It was casual and naturalistic. Church authorities hated it. They told him it looked like a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Then, out of the blue, Haggis got a huge break. He did a favor for a friend who wanted to create a new series that would star Chuck Norris, whose career as an action movie hero had gone into decline. Haggis wrote the pilot for Walker, Texas Ranger, which ran for 8 seasons and was broadcast in 100 countries. Haggis was credited as a co-creator. "It was the most successful thing I ever did," he said. "2 weeks of work, and they never even used my script." With his growing accomplishments and wealth, Haggis became a bigger prize for the church. He agreed to teach a workshop on television writing while he was still the executive producer of Facts of Life, and that brought a number of aspiring scriptwriters into the Celebrity Center. Then, in 1988, Scientology sponsored a Dianetics car in the Indianapolis 500, and Paul and Diane were invited to attend. Executives from the major book chains were attracted to the Scientology reception by the presence of stars including Kirstie Alley and John Travolta, and also by the fact that Hubbard's books have traditionally sold extraordinarily well. B. Dalton ordered 65,000 copies of Dianetics, and Walden Books asked for 100,000. Dianetics went back on the New York Times paperback bestseller list for advice books 38 years after it was originally published. David Miscavige was at the race. It was one of the few times he and Haggis ever met. The organizer of the event, Bill Dendu, recalled that Miscavige was not pleased that Haggis had been invited. Dendu defended his decision because Haggis was now a bona fide celebrity. "He has had a string of hit TV shows and, by my estimation, is a very devoted member of the church," he told Miscavige. Paul and Diane met Miscavige and other top-level members of the church for dinner. "Paul takes no shit from anybody," Dendu recalled. "The fact that he did not suck up to Miscavige, and in fact had a couple of little zingers or one-liners for him while we were at the dinner, that got me some additional browbeating." He added, "You have to understand that no one challenges David Miscavige." The Dianetics car crashed in the first lap. Paul and Diane flew home in Travolta's plane, with Travolta himself at the controls. Suzette Hubbard, Blue, in February 1988. 5 years earlier, she had met Guy White, a Sea Org marketing executive, on the RPF running program, which at the time was in Griffith Park in Los Angeles, about 50 people running all day long, even after dinner, stuffing themselves on bread and honey to keep themselves going. Suzette was warned by an auditor that Guy was gay. In fact, Guy didn't know if he was gay or not. When he joined the staff, he had to respond to a questionnaire that asked, "Have you ever been involved in prostitution, homosexuality, illegal sex, or perversion? Give who, when, where, what in each instance." He had never actually had a homosexual relationship and had been celibate for a decade. Moreover, it was generally assumed that homosexuality was a false identity, a valence in Hubbard's language, and that such longings would disappear when he got to OT3. Suzette and Guy married in March 1986, 3 months after her father died. Their son, Tyson, was born 9 months and a day later. It was strange having a child on Gold Base. Suzette had been pregnant when the order was issued banning Sea Org members from having children. Footnote: according to the church, the Sea Org policy on children changed in 1986. The executive director international, Mr. Guillaume Lesevre, issued the change in policy which provided that Sea Org members could no longer have children and remain in the Sea Org. End footnote. And the only other child around was Roanne, Diana Hubbard's daughter. Other Sea Org members looked upon the children longingly. "People could see what they could never have," Guy White said. The fact that Tyson had been born so soon after Hubbard's death, and that he had shockingly red hair, stirred speculation that he might be a reincarnation of the founder. "Is he? Is he?" they asked themselves. Every church or mission maintains an office for the day Hubbard returns. A pen and a yellow legal pad await him at each of his desks. His personal bathrooms have toothbrushes and identical sets of Tom McCann sandals beside the shower. On Gold Base, his modest original house was razed and replaced with a $10 million mansion. A full-time staff attends the empty residence, regularly laundering the founder's clothes and keeping the house ready for his white-glove inspection. His vehicles are still in the garage, gassed up with the keys in the ignition. On his nightstand is a Louis L'Amour novel with a bookmark placed midway through. The dining table is set for one. The search for Hubbard's reincarnated being resembles the quest for the new Dalai Lama in Tibetan Buddhism, although there are few clues about his identity. He had prophesied that he would be out of action for the next 20 to 25 years. In some versions of the story, Hubbard will be recognized by his red hair, which is why Tyson's birth aroused such expectations. Suzette was terrified that Tyson would be taken away from her. She had little time with him as it was. There was a Sea Org policy written by her father, which mandated an hour a day of family time, but that had been canceled. Now Suzette was pregnant again. Over a period of days, she smuggled toys and clothes via a laundry basket into her little Mazda. Then one night she left a farewell note for Guy, grabbed Tyson, and drove to San Diego. A few days later, she moved in with Mary Sue. Mary Sue was living in a house in the Los Feliz neighborhood of Los Angeles that the church provided when she got out of prison. Amid all the anxiety, Suzette had a miscarriage. After Suzette blew, Guy recalls being sent to Happy Valley and being told he would have to divorce his wife. Jonathan Horwich, Roanne's father, was also in Happy Valley, along with Arthur Hubbard, Ron and Mary Sue's youngest child. One night, while Horwich was supposed to be standing guard, Arthur blew and was never recovered. In October 1988, Guy also decided to escape. Each evening, he went for a stroll along the fence line, a little farther each time, carrying a snack for the German Shepherd guard dogs. One night, he jumped the fence, but the dogs betrayed him and began barking. He had to dive off the road when he saw the lights of the blow team coming after him. For hours, he stumbled through the brush, bleeding, his clothes torn, until he made it to Hemet, where he pounded on the door of a bowling alley. In broken Spanish, he told the person who peeked out that he had been in a car wreck. Guy finally rejoined Suzette. They had two other children before he came out to her as gay. They divorced in 1998. Like Paul Haggis, Tom Cruise had been raised Catholic, although he was more religiously inclined than Paul. His family moved frequently, and he spent part of his childhood in Canada, where he had the reputation of being a headstrong, troublesome, charismatic, and charming boy. His schoolwork suffered because of dyslexia, and he later said that when he graduated from high school, he was a functional illiterate. However, he excelled in sports and drama. His family, like the Haggis family, threw themselves into theater, founding an amateur troupe of players in Ottawa. His antisocial, bullying father was a disruptive force in the family, and early one morning, when Cruz was 12, his mother packed up her three daughters and her precocious son and fled back to America. "We felt like fugitives," Cruz later recalled. Spiritual questing and a tendency toward piety were already features of Cruz's personality. He spent a year in seminary in Cincinnati with a view toward joining the priesthood. But there was another intensely ambitious side that was focused entirely on stardom. He went to Hollywood when he was 18 and managed to get a role in Endless Love, a movie starring Brooke Shields. He was a natural actor, but also persistent and choosy, quickly finding his way into memorable roles. The longing to express his spiritual side had never gone away, but it was difficult in Hollywood to know exactly how to fit that in. There was one church that was especially designed to resolve this dilemma. Cruise's first wife, the actress Mimi Rogers, introduced him to Scientology in 1986. He had just finished filming Top Gun, which had made him the world's biggest movie star. He had little incentive to publicly declare himself a Scientologist after the widespread opprobrium directed at Scientology following the FBI raids on Operation Snow White and the exposure of the church's esoteric beliefs. Rumors of his involvement began to mount, however. For several years, he managed to keep his affiliation quiet, even from church management. Using his birth name, Thomas Maypother IV, he received auditing at a small Scientology mission called the Enhancement Center in Sherman Oaks, which Rogers had started with her former husband. Rogers' close friend and former roommate, Kirstie Alley, did her auditing there, along with singer and later congressman Sonny Bono, who had also been brought into the church by Rogers. Cruise would later credit Scientology's study methods for helping him overcome his dyslexia. The triumph of adding Cruise to the Scientology stable was fraught with problems. Mimi Rogers was at the top of that list. Her parents had been involved with Dianetics since the early days of the movement. In 1957, when Mimi was a year old, they had moved to Washington, D.C. to work for Hubbard, and her father, Philip Spickler, had briefly joined the Sea Org. But Mimi's parents had become disaffected by the end of the 70s. They were considered squirrels because they continued to practice Scientology outside the guidance of the church. It would be one thing to have Tom Cruise as a trophy for Scientology, but it would be a disaster if he became a walking advertisement for the squirrels. When Miscavige learned of Cruise's involvement in Scientology, he arranged to have the star brought to Gold Base alone at its secret location near Hemet in August 1989. He assigned his top people to audit and supervise the young star during his first weekend stay. Cruise arrived wearing a baseball cap and dark glasses, trying to keep a low profile, although everyone on the base knew he was there. Cruise was preparing to make Days of Thunder that fall. He had just seen a 21-year-old Australian actress, Nicole Kidman, in the thriller Dead Calm, and he was so enchanted that he cast her in a part she was far too young to play, a brain surgeon who brings Cruise's character back to life after he crashes his race car. They had an immediate, intense connection, one that quickly became a subject of tabloid speculation. According to Rathbun, Cruise and Miscavige now had a common interest, getting rid of Mimi. She demanded and received a church mediation of their relationship, which involves each partner being put on e-meters and confessing their crimes in front of the other. But with Cruise ready to move on and Miscavige seemingly set against her, Rogers stood little chance. Marty Rathbun and a church attorney went to her home carrying divorce papers. "I told her this was the right thing to do for Tom because he was going to do lots of good for Scientology," Rathbun recalled. That was the end of Mimi Rogers. Rogers later said that she and Cruise were already having difficulty in their marriage. He had been seriously thinking about becoming a monk, in which case marriage wouldn't fit into his plans. "He thought he had to be celibate to maintain the purity of his instrument," she told Playboy. "Therefore, it became obvious that we had to split." After 2 years, Annie Broker had worked her way out of Happy Valley. She was assigned to Gold Base, which serves as the headquarters for the Commodore's Messengers Org, Golden Era Productions, which makes Scientology films and manufactures the audiovisual materials for the church, as well as e-meters, and the Religious Technology Center, which enforces the orthodoxy of Scientology practices. Through his position as chairman of the RTC, Miscavige directed the church's operations, spending much of his time living on the base. Rathbun and other top executives were also living and working on the 500-acre base, which was still so hush-hush that few Scientologists knew of its existence. Rathbun believed that Miscavige wanted Annie close by in case Pat Broker ever stirred back to life. An ex-Marine named Andre Tabayoyan, who oversaw construction of the security at the gold base, later testified that church funds were used to purchase assault rifles, shotguns, and pistols. He also said that explosive devices were placed around the perimeter to be used in case of assault by law enforcement officials. Surrounded by a security fence with 3-inch spikes, patrolled by armed guards, and monitored by cameras, motion detectors, infrared scanners, and a sniper's nest at the top of a hill, the property houses about 800 Sea Org members in conditions that the church describes as like one you would find in a convent or seminary, albeit much more comfortable. Annie resumed using her maiden name, Tidman. Although she was continuously under guard, she had fallen in love with another Sea Org member, Jim Logan, the same man who had recruited Paul Haggis into Scientology on the street corner in London, Ontario. Annie had met Logan in Happy Valley when both were on the RPF. Jim and Annie married in June 1990 and moved to Sea Org berthing near Gold Base. Logan was no longer the long-haired hippie he had been in those days. He was now middle-aged and balding, with a black mustache, but he still had those intense, playful eyes and a ready laugh. His outsized, boisterous personality didn't always fit well in the highly regimented life he had signed up for. In the summer of 1992, Logan was served with a non-enturbulation order, which meant that he should stop stirring things up. In October, 8 men came to escort him to a detention facility where troublesome staff members were confined. Logan was told that he had been declared a suppressive person and was going to be booted out of the Sea Org. Annie had previously confided that she was finished with the Sea Org and would leave if Jim was ready. He didn't want to go then. He still hoped to rehabilitate himself in the eyes of the church, but Annie made application to formally rout out of the Sea Org. In a few months, if all went well, they would have a quiet reunion in Nova Scotia where they could have children and forget the past. Annie promised him, "They can't make me divorce you." But on October 8, 1992, Logan's last day in the Sea Org, church officials told him that Annie had been ordered to disconnect from him. He was served with divorce papers, given a freeloader tab for more than $350,000, and then dropped off at the bus station with a ticket to Bangor, Maine. Several times after that, Jim and Annie were able to speak secretly. She would manage to sneak a call to him late at night, or he would have his mother call her. When Annie couldn't wait any longer to see him, Jim bought her an open ticket from Ontario, California, the nearest airport, to Bangor. It would be waiting for her to pick up whenever she wanted. A few weeks later, Jim got a call from Annie. She was on her way. It was about 5 a.m. in California. She was catching a flight that stopped in Denver, then went on to Boston, where she would change planes for Bangor. Jim set out from Nova Scotia for the 9-hour drive to the airport. Rathbun got the message that Annie had fled the base about 1.5 hours after she left. He was panicked. Annie knew as well as anyone the inside story of the secret money transfers to Hubbard, the offshore accounts, the shredding of incriminating documents. She could torpedo the church's application for tax-exempt status. She also knew the true circumstances of Hubbard's last days. She might even reunite with Pat Broker, and the two of them could pose a challenge to Miscavige. Rathbun saw Annie as a potential doomsday machine. According to Gary Moorhead, the hulking chief of security at Gold Base at the time, a blow drill went into effect immediately. Moorhead had refined the process to a model of Sea Org efficiency. Each year, a minimum of 100 people attempted to escape from Gold, but few got away cleanly. Morehead's security team kept files on members, containing bank account and credit card numbers, family contacts, even hobbies and predilections. When one senior executive fled in 1992, for instance, Morehead knew he was a baseball fan. He caught him a week later in the parking lot of the San Francisco Giants stadium. Morehead's team was aided by the isolation of the base. Gold was in a narrow valley in the middle of the desert, 7 miles from the village of Hemet. There was a single highway, easy to patrol. Mountain ranges enclosed the base on either side, and the rocky slopes were copiously supplied with cactus and rattlesnakes. Many of the Sea Org members had neither the resources nor the skills to get very far. There was an ingrained distrust of the non-Scientology WOG world and its system of justice, as well as a fatalistic view of the reach of the church, especially among Sea Org members who, like Annie, had grown up in Scientology. Those who had cell phones used them mainly as walkie-talkies for communication on the base. Phone records were monitored, and the phones would be taken away if they were used to make outside calls. Few of them had cars of their own or even driver's licenses, so the best they could do was to try to get to the bus station before they were discovered missing. By the time the bus made its next stop, however, there was usually a member of Morehead's team waiting for them. If that failed, Morehead's security squad would stake out the houses of the blown members' family and friends using scanners that could listen in on cordless phones and cell phones and running the license plates of everyone who came and went. When the team finally confronted their prey, they would try to talk them into returning to the base voluntarily. If that failed, occasionally they would use force. Footnote. The church denies that there is such a thing as the blow drill. The church produced an affidavit by Morehead, executed March 31, 1997, in which he says, "I have seen people leave, and they were free to do so. I am now doing so myself. I am aware of stories of individuals claiming to have been held against their will, but I know for myself and from my security position that the stories are completely false." Morehead repudiates the statement, saying, "In March of 1997, at that specific moment, I would have signed anything." End footnote. Most of those who fled were torn by conflicting emotions. On the one hand, they were often frightened, humiliated, and angry. They desperately wanted a life outside the organization. Some, like Annie, wanted to have children, which she was forbidden to do as a Sea Org member. On the other hand, they believed that their eternal salvation was at stake. The youthful enthusiasm that had caused them to sign their billion-year contract of service may have been dampened, but there was usually some residual idealism that the security team could appeal to. Typically, in these confrontations, Morehead would bring along the escapee's opinion leader, which could be his case supervisor or another family member who was in Scientology, his wife or his mother, for instance. In many instances, the fleeing Sea Org member didn't even argue. He just gave up, knowing that he would probably be taken directly to RPF, where he might spend months or years working his way back into good standing. At any time, a fleeing member could guarantee his safety by simply calling the police, but that rarely, if ever, happened. The Riverside County Sheriff's Department, whose jurisdiction includes Gold Base, says that there has never been an outcry of abuse or an accusation of illegal detention from members of the church at the base. Although the Sea Org members lived inside a highly secure compound in a desert hideaway, surrounded by fences and high-tech sensors, most of them weren't really being held against their will. On the contrary, it was their will that held them. But according to Morehead, no one who escaped ever returned voluntarily. As soon as Morehead learned that Annie had blown, his team began combing through her personal effects, calling hotels and motels in the area and looking for clues as to where she was headed. The easiest way of doing that was to have someone pretend to be Annie and try to book a flight, then be told, for instance, "Oh, we already have you on the 1110 flight to Boston." If that didn't work, another member would call the airlines posing as a sick relative and demand help in finding the missing son or wife or whatever. If the airline representative refused to give out that information, the member would continue asking to speak to a higher-up until he got the information. In one case, it was the vice president of an airline who, thinking he was responding to a family medical emergency, gave up the pertinent details. Moorhead also hired former FBI or CIA agents as private investigators. As soon as an escapee made the mistake of using a credit card, the team would know almost immediately where the charge was placed. Moorhead was always surprised at how easily such supposedly confidential information could be obtained. His team quickly learned that Annie was on the flight to Boston. Minutes later, Marty Rathbun lit out for the airport at 100 miles an hour. He didn't even have time to change clothes. He was wearing a T-shirt, sweatpants, and sneakers. His secretary booked a direct flight that would arrive at Boston only 20 minutes after Annie's and just 20 minutes before her connecting flight to Bangor. It was winter and snowing in Boston when he landed at 10 at night, when most of the air traffic had ended. He ran through the nearly empty corridors of Logan Airport to the gate for the Bangor flight. There was a stairwell that led downstairs and a door that opened to the tarmac. Rathbun rushed outside into the frigid air. The passengers were still on the ramp. Annie was only 6 feet away from him. "Annie!" he cried. She turned around. As soon as she saw who it was, her shoulders slumped and she walked toward him. Rathbun talked to Miss Gavage and said that he would get a couple of hotel rooms in Boston and bring Annie back in the morning, but Miss Gavage was unwilling to risk it. He told Rathbun that he had already arranged for John Travolta's jet to pick them up a few hours later. Annie and Jim Logan were finally divorced on August 26, 1993. He never saw her again. She died in 2011 of lung cancer at the age of 55. By his actions, Miscavige showed his instinctive understanding of how to cater to the sense of entitlement that comes with great stardom. It was not just a matter of disposing of awkward personal problems, such as clinging spouses. There were also the endless demands for nourishment of an ego that is always aware of the fragility of success, the longing for privacy that is constantly at war with the demand for recognition, the need to be fortified against ordinariness and feelings of mortality, and the sense that the quality of the material world that surrounds you reflects upon your own value, and therefore everything must be made perfect. These were qualities Miscavige demanded for himself as well. He surrounded Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman with an approving and completely deferential environment, as spotless and odorless as a fairy tale. A special bungalow was prepared for their stay at Gold Base, along with a private rose garden. When the couple longed to play tennis, a court was rehabilitated at significant expense. Miscavige heard about the couple's fantasy of running through a field of wildflowers together, so he had Sea Org members plant a section of the desert. When that failed to meet his expectations, the meadow was plowed up and sodded with grass. Miscavige assigned them a personal chef, Sinar Parman, who had cooked for Hubbard and had a high-end gym constructed that was mainly for the use of Cruz and himself. When a flood triggered a mudslide that despoiled the couple's romantic bungalow, Miscavige held the entire base responsible and ordered everyone to work 16-hour days until everything was restored to its previous pristine condition. In July 1990, Cruz's involvement with the church became public in an article in the tabloid Star. Cruz himself didn't admit his affiliation until 2 years later in an interview with Barbara Walters. The fact that the information was leaked, probably from a source within the church, was at once a great embarrassment for Miscavige and a relief, because Cruz's name was now finally linked irrevocably in the public mind with Scientology. He offered an unparalleled conduit to Hollywood celebrity culture, and Miscavige went to great lengths to court him. At Thanksgiving 1990, he ordered Parmen to cook dinner for Cruz's whole family. Miscavige even arranged for Cruz to place some investments with the Feshbach brothers, Kurt, Joseph, and Matthew, three Palo Alto, California stockbrokers. They were devoted Scientologists who had made a fortune by selling short on the stock market. According to Rathbun, when Cruz's investments actually lost money, the Feshbachs obligingly replenished the star's account with their personal funds.